Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written for people learning English. Coming up, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We also have Words and Their Stories from Anna Mateo. And we close the show with an American story. But first,
the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, has brought a lawsuit against Visa. It is accusing the financial services company of using illegal methods to block competition in the debit card market. The lawsuit states the San Francisco-based company penalizes businesses and banks that do not use Visa's own payment processing technology. The DOJ argues that Visa's anti-competition methods cost individuals and businesses billions of dollars every year. Visa earns money for each purchase or transaction processed on its own network. The DOJ estimates about 60% of debit transactions in the U.S. take place on Visa's debit network. This adds up to more than $7 billion each year. In a statement, Attorney General Merrick Garland said the DOJ found that Visa had unlawfully gained enough power to charge money or fees that far exceed what it could charge in a competitive market. Garland added that businesses and banks then pass those costs on to consumers. They either raise prices or reduce quality or service. As a result, Visa's business methods affect not just the price of one thing, but the price of nearly everything. Julie Rottenberg is Visa's chief legal counsel. She said in a statement that the lawsuit does not consider the ever-expanding universe of companies offering new ways to pay for goods and services. Today's lawsuit ignores the reality that Visa is just one of many competitors in a debit space that is growing, with entrants who are thriving, Rottenberg said. She added that the company would strongly defend itself against the meritless lawsuit. The lawsuit was brought in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. The DOJ argues that the huge number of transactions completed on Visa's network makes it difficult for businesses to use alternative companies. The DOJ also accuses Visa of blocking competition by paying to enter into partnership agreements with possible competitors. In 2020, the DOJ brought legal action to block the company's $5.3 billion purchase of financial technology startup Plaid. It argued the takeover was an attempt to gain control of a possible competitor to Visa. The purchase deal was later canceled. Financial records show Visa processed $3.3 trillion in transactions on its network during the 3 months ending on June 30th. This was an increase of 7.4% from a year earlier. U.S. payments grew by 5.1%, which is a lot faster than U.S. economic growth.
The Japanese video game company Nintendo is opening a museum that will teach visitors about its history. At the museum, fans of Super Mario, The Legend of Zelda, and the Game Boy and Switch devices can learn more about one of the world's most famous game makers. The museum is in Uji near the company's Kyoto headquarters. It will show the many developments of Nintendo, which was founded in 1889. The company began as a maker of Hanafuda playing cards and has since grown to offer many kinds of electronic games. Shigeru Miyamoto is an executive fellow at Nintendo and the creator of Super Mario. Miyamoto said the museum was meant to deepen understanding of the company. If making products while protecting concepts such as family, fun, and ease of understanding is rooted in our employees, then the new Nintendo will continue to grow, he told reporters recently. The museum, which opens to the public October 2nd, is in the place where the company used to make playing cards and was a center for product repairs. On its website, tickets to the museum are sold out for 2 months after the opening. In addition to showing famous devices such as the Wii console and the handheld Game Boy, visitors will be able to see lesser-known products. These include the Mama Berica baby stroller and the Copilus printer. The museum also offers special experiences. Visitors, for example, will be able to work together to play the video game Super Mario Brothers on an oversized family computer controller. The company's push into mobile gaming has dropped off, but other efforts by Nintendo to grow beyond its main, or core, gaming business have made progress. The company has been opening stores and employing its characters in theme parks and movies. The Switch console has been a major success, with over 140 million devices in use. But, with sales slowing, investor attention is now on the possibility for a new device. Nintendo aims to announce details of a possible new device in the current financial year, which ends in March. I'm John Russell.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Alvaro about the usage of the words insight and thought. Dear teacher, I want to ask you the difference between insights and thoughts. Best regards, Alvaro. Thank you for writing to us, Alvaro. I'm happy to answer this question. Thoughts is a more general word than insights. A thought can be specific, as the following examples show.
I think we should go shopping tomorrow. I think the dog might be hungry.
Thoughts can also be a collection of ideas about a subject. For example, we ask, "What are your thoughts on this?" That can mean we want people to share any ideas they have about the subject. It can also mean that we want to know a person's opinion. To have insight means to have a special understanding of something. A person with insight might notice something that most people do not see or understand. A person with insight might find a new solution to a problem. Insight often results from having a lot of experience with a particular subject or activity. We can say that someone has insight into someone or something. For example, a good psychologist might have insight into why a person is feeling or behaving in a particular way. Notice that with the noun insight, we often use the preposition into after it. With insight, we often use the verbs have or gain, as in the following examples.
Their manager has a lot of insight into what the workers need. By carefully watching the children's behavior, the researchers gained insight into how children try to solve problems.
The adjective form of insight is insightful, and the adjective form of thought is thoughtful. To be thoughtful has two meanings. It can mean to be kind or to take care of the needs of others. For example, a thoughtful person may listen carefully to a friend who is upset and then offer to help that person. So, when someone does something nice to help us, we might say,
"Oh, that is so thoughtful of you. Thanks."
Thoughtful can also describe someone who has been thinking carefully. For our readers and listeners, what are your thoughts about American English? Do you have any insights to share? Or perhaps you simply have a question about particular words. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And please include where you are from in your email, too. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Learning a language is difficult. Sometimes it requires a plan and resources, but it also usually requires hard work. People who persist with their language goals often get good results. They keep working even through hard times. They keep their nose to the grindstone. When you keep your nose to the grindstone, you work very hard for a long time at something. You don't give up. How do we use this idiom in daily life? How did it come to mean perseverance? And just what is a grindstone? We answer all these questions on today's show. First, let's talk about a grindstone. A grindstone is a large, circular stone with a hole in the middle. An axle fits through that hole. When the stone turns quickly on the axle, it can sharpen, shape, or smooth a tool. And that brings us to the beginnings of this idiom. On his website, Phrase Finder, writer and language researcher Gary Martin suggests two possible beginnings. Both are set in work environments of long ago. A place for milling grain and a place for sharpening tools. Some online sources claim that keeping your nose to the grindstone comes from milling grain. If the stone got too hot while grinding, it could burn the grain. So workers would have to keep their noses close to the stone and smell for any sign of burning. However, word expert Martin says that doesn't seem true. He claims that these mills used millstones. So if this story were true, we would say, keep your nose to the millstone. But we don't. He also notes that the terms millstone and grindstone were used interchangeably hundreds of years ago. But then at some point long ago, that stopped. Grain mills used millstones and not grindstones, and vice versa. Tool sharpening workshops used grindstones and not millstones. So let's talk about the explanation set in a tool sharpening workshop. Martin talks about old workshops in his area of England. He says these workshops have benches very near to grinding stones. Workers would sit on the benches, hunched over, and work very hard and very long. He goes on to write the following.
They had to pay close attention to their work, as a moment too long on the wheel could cause the steel to overheat and be ruined.
Martin guesses that this story is the more likely explanation. Imagine being hunched over your work and working hard at it. Life can't be all about work. So if you've been keeping your nose to the grindstone, remember to take a break. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. Today, we will hear the second and final part of the story.
Don't know whether there'll be a fight or not, answered one man firmly. But there'll be some shooting, some good shooting.
The young man who had warned them waved his hand.
Oh, there'll be a fight fast enough if anyone wants it. Anybody can get in a fight out there in the street. There's a fight just waiting.
The salesman seemed to be realizing the possibility of personal danger.
What did you say his name was?
He asked.
Scratchy Wilson,
voices answered together.
And will he kill anybody? What are you going to do? Does this happen often? Can he break in that door?
No, he can't break in that door, replied the saloon keeper. He's tried it 3 times. But when he comes, you better lie down on the floor, stranger. He's sure to shoot at the door, and a bullet may come through.
After that, the salesman watched the door steadily. The time had not yet come for him to drop to the floor, but he carefully moved near the wall.
Will he kill anybody?
He asked again. The men laughed without humor at the question.
He's here to shoot, and he's here for trouble. I don't see any good in experimenting with him.
But what do you do in a situation like this? What can you do?
A man answered. Well, he and Jack Potter,
but
the other men interrupted together. Jack Potter's in San Antonio.
Well, who is he? What's he got to do with this?
Oh, he's the town policeman. He goes out and fights Scratchy when he starts acting this way.
A nervous, waiting silence was upon them. The salesman saw that the saloon keeper, without a sound, had taken a gun from a hiding place. Then he saw the man signal to him, so he moved across the room. You better come with me behind this table.
No thanks, said the salesman. I'd rather be where I can get out the back door. At that, the saloon keeper made a kindly but forceful motion. The salesman obeyed and found himself seated on a box with his head below the level of the table. The saloon keeper sat comfortably upon a box nearby.
You see, he whispered, Scratchy Wilson is a wonder with a gun, a perfect wonder. And when he gets excited, everyone gets out of his path. He's a terror when he's drunk. When he's not drinking, he's all right. Wouldn't hurt anything. Nicest fella in town. But when he's drunk, be careful.
There were periods of stillness.
I wish Jack Potter were back from San Antonio, said the saloon keeper. He shot Wilson once, in the leg. He'd come in and take care of this thing. Soon, they heard from a distance the sound of a shot, followed by three wild screams. The men looked at each other. Here he comes, they said.
A man in a red shirt turned a corner and walked into the middle of the main street of Yellow Sky. In each hand, the man held a long, heavy, blue-black gun. Often he screamed, and these cries rang through the seemingly deserted village. The screams sounded sharply over the roofs with a power that seemed to have no relation to the ordinary strength of a man's voice. These fierce cries rang against walls of silence. The man's face flamed in a hot anger born of whiskey. His eyes, rolling but watchful, hunted the still doorways and windows. He walked with the movement of a midnight cat. As the thoughts came to him, he roared threatening information. The long guns hung from his hands like feathers. They were moved with electric speed. The muscles of his neck straightened and sank as passion moved him. The only sounds were his terrible invitations to battle. The calm houses preserved their dignity at the passing of this small thing in the middle of the street. There was no offer of fight, no offer of fight. The man called to the sky. There were no answers. He screamed and shouted and waved his guns here and everywhere. Finally, the man was at the closed door of the saloon. He went to it and, beating upon it with his gun, demanded drink. The door remained closed. He picked up a bit of paper from the street and nailed it to the frame of the door with a knife. Then he turned his back upon the place and walked to the opposite side of the street. Turning quickly and easily, he fired the guns at the bit of paper. He missed it by half an inch. He cursed at himself and went away. Later, he comfortably shot out all the windows of the house of his best friend. Scratchy was playing with this town. It was a toy for him. But still, there was no offer of fight. The name of Jack Potter, his ancient enemy, entered his mind. He decided that it would be a good thing if he went to Potter's house and, by shooting at it, make him come out and fight. He moved in the direction of his desire, singing some sort of war song. When he arrived at it, Potter's house presented the same still front as had the other homes. Taking a good position, the man screamed an invitation to battle. But this house regarded him as a great stone god might have done. It gave no sign. After a little wait, the man screamed more invitations, mixing them with wonderful curses. After a while came the sight of a man working himself into deepest anger over the stillness of a house. He screamed at it. He shot again and again. He paused only for breath or to reload his guns. Potter and his bride walked rapidly. Sometimes they laughed together, quietly and a little foolishly.
"Next corner, dear," he said finally.
They put forth the efforts of a pair walking against a strong wind.
Potter was ready to point the first appearance of the new home. Then, as they turned the corner, they came face to face with the man in the red shirt, who was feverishly loading a large gun. Immediately, the man dropped his empty gun to the ground and, like lightning, pulled out another. The second gun was aimed at Potter's chest. There was a silence. Potter couldn't open his mouth. Quickly, he loosened his arm from the woman's grasp and dropped the bag to the sand. As for the bride, her face had become the color of an old cloth. She was motionless. The two men faced each other at a distance of 9 feet. Behind the gun, Wilson smiled with a new and quiet cruelty. "Tried to surprise me," he said. "Tried to surprise me." His eyes grew more evil. As Potter made a slight movement, the man pushed his gun sharply forward. "No, don't you do it, Jack Potter. Don't you move a finger toward a gun yet. Don't you move a muscle. The time has come for me to settle with you, and I'm going to do it my own way, slowly, with no interruption. So just listen to what I tell you." Potter looked at his enemy. "I haven't got a gun with me, Scratchy," he said. "Honest, I haven't." He was stiffening and steadying. But at the back of his mind floated a picture of the beautiful car on the train. He thought of the glory of the wedding, the spirit of his new life. "You know I fight when I have to fight, Scratchy Wilson. But I haven't got a gun with me. You have to do all the shooting yourself." His enemy's face turned pale with anger. He stepped forward and whipped his gun back and forth before Potter's chest. "Don't you tell me you haven't got a gun with you, you dog! Don't you tell me a lie like that! There isn't a man in Texas who ever saw you without a gun! Don't think I'm a kid!" His eyes burned with anger and his breath came heavily. "I don't think you're a kid," answered Potter. His feet had not moved an inch backward. "I think you're a complete fool. I tell you I haven't got a gun, and I haven't. If you're going to shoot me, you better begin now. You'll never get a chance like this again." So much enforced reasoning had weakened Wilson's anger. He was calmer. "If you haven't got a gun, why haven't you got a gun?" he asked. "Been to church?" "I haven't got a gun because I've just come from San Antonio with my wife. I'm married," said Potter. "And if I had thought there'd be a fool like you here when I brought my wife home, I would have had a gun, and don't you forget it."
"Married?" said Scratchy, not at all understanding.
"Yes, married. I'm married," said Potter clearly.
"Married?" said Scratchy.
Seemingly for the first time, he saw the pale, frightened woman at the other side.
"No!"
he said. He was like a creature allowed a glance at another world. He moved a pace backward, and his arm with the gun dropped to his side.
"Is this the lady?"
he asked. "Yes, this is the lady," answered Potter. There was another period of silence.
"Well," said Wilson at last, slowly, "I suppose we won't fight now."
"We won't if you say so, Scratchy. You know, I didn't make the trouble." Potter lifted the bag.
"Well, I guess we won't fight, Jack," said Wilson.
He was looking at the ground.
"Married."
He was not a student of good manners. It was merely that in the presence of this foreign condition, he was a simple child of the wildlands. He picked up his fallen gun, and he went away. His feet made deep tracks in the heavy sand.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.